decay. It happens to everything and everyone. We try to keep it out of our everyday lives, but decay is one of the most important forces in nature. It underpins all life on Earth. So what would we see if we let it loose in our homes?
A reproduction of a modern home contained within glass walls.
To find out, we've built a home of our own inside this box.
A wide variety of foods.
We've filled it with everything you might find in a typical kitchen and garden. And now we're going to let it all rot. Well, here it is. A team of engineers, scientists and technicians have spent 8 months recreating a kitchen and garden. On the inside is all the food you'd expect, as if a family were just about to have a party. But also on the inside are the bacteria and fungal spores that are going to start the process of decay. I can't wait to see what happens next. Over 8 weeks, we're going to track every step of the extraordinary process that breaks down and recycles our everyday things. The house will be our lab as we reveal the unexpected order behind the chaos of decay, and will help us understand why life itself depends on this process. At times, what we find might be disturbing and repellent.
This is probably going to be absolutely atrocious.
But there'll also be moments of surprise. The mould has just covered that entire box. As we uncover hidden beauty.
A delicate white mould and hundreds of tiny dark spores. Then the tentacular eyes of a snail. A beetle using its mandibles to eat a white substance. Then the compound eyes of a fly.
And I'll go beyond the box to see how decay affects our lives. How we detect it.
Do you remember seeing the film The Blob?
How we fight it.
Well, it's definitely the best 2-year-old sandwich I ever had.
Something on this scale has never been attempted before, so things might not go according to plan.
Ah, now that's where all the flies went.
But whatever happens, it will be a fascinating journey into the fate that awaits all living things. To be broken down. To be recycled. To be reborn.
Afterlife. The strange science of decay. The clean and modern kitchen that's been built within the afterlife house. A large bowl of fresh fruit.
It's a surprising thought. Life relies on death. Living things, us included, can only be made from the remains of dead things. And that's the incredible cycle we hope to capture inside our afterlife house. As a biologist, I can't wait to see what new life will emerge from these dead things by the time we're done. This is day one. We have 8 weeks to go.
Day one.
Well, this is my first chance to see inside the box. And a party was obviously just about to happen. Over here, we've got cooked rice and chili. There's cups of tea. Over in the corner here, there's a fish. Now, that's going to get very smelly pretty fast. Cheese, fruit bowl here, masses of fruit flies on that, probably. I mean, we don't know. It hasn't been tried before. Vegetable box over here. Again, it all looks fresh, but that will, in about a week or two's time, begin to rot down. And look at this. A raw chicken. Sausages, hamburgers, all this is going to attract flies like nobody's business. And out here in the garden, we've got a whole pig on a spit, and that's going to become very smelly indeed. But it's not just food items out here in the garden. We have a compost heap, we have a wood pile. They'll rot down too. It'll be very interesting to see how, as all these things decay, the wood and the plants and the pig, how they all interact. Over there on the corner, we've got a dead rat as well. In fact, everything here has been carefully arranged to help us unravel the underlying patterns of decay. We're going to keep an eye on how humid it is in here and how hot it is. It's already up to 66% RH, which is going to make things go really quite fast. I'm not sure if I'm going to be overcome first by the heat, the stench, or the flies. Insects are my own speciality. Together with moulds and bacteria, they are key agents of decay, things that will break all this down. To make sure they're all present in our house from the start, we're introducing a selection of common species. Look at that, straight underneath. These guys, blowflies, are going to be the ones to watch in the early stages.
And there they go. Well, that's it. We're up and running, and it's time to leave all this to the agents of decay.
Now, for nearly 2 months, we're going to track every stage in the process of decay. And we're not the only ones following events. The box and its contents are on display to the public within Edinburgh Zoo. They'll help us explore our reactions to this little understood process.
Oh my God, I never see anything like it.
That's a real pig.
That's gross.
Oh, there's a mouse.
That's disgusting.
Ooh,
look at that fish.
Don't go out now because it's going to make us feel sick.
I agree.
Day 2. Presenter Dr. George McGavin studies what's happening inside the box on some screens.
For the first 24 hours of our project, visible signs of decay are subtle. But the agents of decay are already battling it out to decompose the food and get to the nutrients locked inside. I want to investigate who's got the advantage in this opening stage.
By the cooker.
Well, it's the second day and it's really warm in here. It's 25 degrees. That's like a warm summer day. So some things are drying out. The chili con carne is already growing a layer of mould on it. And that shows that there are fungal spores drifting around in the atmosphere all the time and settling out on food. Over here, the sandwiches, which originally filled the whole box up to the top, have sagged down to about half their height. But what's really interesting me is what's happening over here.
The raw chicken.
The most obvious change so far has been on the surface of our chicken. Our time-lapse cameras show these blotches appearing on its skin over the course of the past day. To find out what's producing them, I've asked Dr. Claire Taylor, a microbiologist, to join me.
The chicken's skin's increasingly blotchy.
Well, Claire, that chicken is beginning to look pretty discoloured.
And smells a bit as well, doesn't it?
You can get a slight whiff. What have we got on this now?
Tell you what I've got. We have a UV light here, so we can take a look a bit more closely at the surface.
Okay. Now, ultraviolet I use for other things, but I'm interested to see what happens here.
No, you can't see it.
No, I can't see anything. Whoa!
And take a look at that.
That's glowing.
Yep.
That. So all these areas are glowing sort of blue.
Exactly. So where you can see those glowing bits,
yeah,
that's bacteria.
Any particular kind?
Well, that's likely to be Pseudomonas.
A slender thread of bright blue.
Pseudomonas is a common type of food spoilage bacteria. Our microscope shows a whole colony glowing under the ultraviolet light.
The bacteria under magnification.
There could be as many as a billion individual bacterial cells in this sample alone. In terms of sheer numbers, bacteria are the most common agents of decay on the planet. And on dead animals, they're the first to attack, because they're already on the scene. All creatures carry bacteria while they're alive. These Pseudomonas bacteria were on our chicken before it was killed, feeding on its skin secretions. And now it's dead, they've quickly switched to decomposing its flesh. With ample food and enough moisture,
they've multiplied rapidly. As colonies of bacteria like this expand, something surprising happens. The bacteria start to coordinate their actions, working together to benefit the colony.
The bacteria send signals to each other to direct what they do. So the bacteria are actually talking to each other, telling each other where they need to go.
These E. coli bacteria have been genetically modified to allow us to see this in action. When the colony reaches a critical size, all the bacteria start flashing in unison. Bacteria are constantly exchanging chemicals that allow them to sense their own numbers and those of rival colonies. They can even detect when they have the numbers to overwhelm a competitor.
Pulsing blue lights indicate the areas the bacteria's most active in.
Back on our chicken, these tactics have allowed food spoilage bacteria to gain the upper hand. But their actions are setting off a chain of events that will attract a whole new set of decomposers. As they break down the cells of the chicken to feast on the protein inside, the bacteria are releasing strong-smelling gases. Blowflies can pick up the smell of decomposing flesh within minutes of an animal's death. So it's likely they've already laid eggs in the chicken and other meat throughout the box. We'll find out if we start seeing maggots in the next few days. These gases send a signal to us too. It's our most important clue that food spoilage bacteria have been at work.
Right, let's see what folks make of these chicken drumsticks.
I want to see how sensitive we are to even the smallest signs of decay.
Hi guys, would you care to have a smell of this?
George wafts the smell towards the visitors.
So, if you found that in your house, what would you do?
I wouldn't eat it, no. I think I'd put it in the bin. I'd throw it away immediately.
Yeah.
Immediately.
Yeah, it's disgusting.
We fight a daily battle to keep this kind of decay out of our kitchens. Looking around the box already makes me think about what a challenge this really is. Decay is a relentless opponent. So I'm interested in exploring what we've learned about delaying its effects. And in America, there's a team that's taking on the ultimate food preservation challenge.
Fort Benning, USA.
Keep your head down, it's gonna get shot off, you.
Now, this is not necessarily the first place I think of when it comes to the latest advances in food science, but the US Army is right on the front line in the war against decay.
Feeding an army in the field has always presented a challenge. Soldiers need food that is quick to prepare, light to carry, and long-lasting. Traditionally, the US military uses vacuum-packed food called MREs, meals ready to eat. Special packaging stops moisture and oxygen getting in so bacteria can't grow. MREs have a shelf life of 3 years. There's a problem though. MREs are not exactly popular with the people who have to eat them.
Hands down, worst MRE made is the veggie omelet. It's like eating just wet, soggy cardboard is the best way I think you can describe it.
If I had to eat an MRE every day, that would basically suck.
So when the army went looking for ways to spruce up the menu, it wanted something more appealing. Something that was quick and easy to eat and could deliver the huge amounts of energy that soldiers require. The solution was a surprise. A sandwich. But not just any sandwich. A sandwich that remains fresh and tasty in the field for up to 3 years,
without refrigeration, freeze drying, or the need to add water. That is extreme preservation. So how did they do it? Food scientist Michelle Richardson was part of the team that developed the sandwich. Her first challenge was to control the moisture you'd find in a typical sandwich.
Michelle lays out some sandwiches on a table.
These sandwiches do not look very happy.
Well, this, they really don't.
That's a ham and cheese wedge. That's been in the car for 3 days. If we open it, we'll just have a look at this thing, because it's if you had that in your backpack for 3 days, that was just a normal shop-bought sandwich. But it's soggy. It's really soggy. Look at that. It's just, I mean, you wouldn't really want to eat that in the field.
No, you really wouldn't want to eat it for two reasons. It wouldn't taste good because the texture is not what you typically get. And then also, because of that moisture excess, you may have bacteria growing in it.
If you can control the moisture, you can slow down the process of decay. Without water, bacteria cannot grow. That's why drying is the classic way to stop food decaying. But a sandwich without water would be inedible. So Michelle has taken inspiration from another classic preservation technique.
Well, this right here is strawberry jam. As you can see in here, it's very firm.
Yeah.
It's made from strawberries. Most fruits and vegetables contain a lot of water, like probably 95% water.
Okay.
But by adding different ingredients, what that does is that it holds the water in very tightly.
Right, so it's locked away in there.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
The sugar added to jam acts as what's called a humectant. It traps the water from the fruit inside the jam. That's why the jam is moist enough to spread, but doesn't make the bread go soggy. Crucially for the battle against decay, the water is also now locked away from bacteria. The Army sandwiches deploy a whole range of ingredients that have these water-retaining properties. Honey, sugar, and salt have all been enlisted. Bacteria need water to thrive. Most also need oxygen. Michelle has found a way to cut off supplies of that as well.
Now, when I opened the pack, I found this inside.
Mm-hmm.
And I assume that's not edible.
No, it's not.
What's this for?
This is an oxygen scavenger. And basically what's contained in here are little iron shavings.
All right. Iron filings.
If there is any oxygen or moisture still inside the packaging, they'll react with the iron filings and become trapped in a layer of rust.
This will prevent, you know, yeast and mold from growing, as well as bacteria, but it also will prevent, like, any chemical reactions that require oxygen from taking place.
This is one seriously high-tech sandwich.
Yeah, it is.
These simple but ingenious solutions have combined to make a food that is highly resistant to decay. But the ultimate test is whether anyone wants to eat it.
Well, it's definitely the best 2-year-old sandwich I've ever had. There are a lot of new ones I've had, too.
I'm a big fan. I like the bread. The bread just makes it. It's definitely great, especially 2 years old.
These sandwiches don't stay fresh forever. But they do show that if you can reduce the moisture and oxygen that bacteria thrive on, you can hold off decay for a very long time.
Day 8. George studies events inside the box.
Back at the house, water and oxygen certainly aren't in short supply, so bacteria are thriving. And over the last 8 days of decay, we've started to see the first maggots appearing in our pig. I'd expect their numbers to rocket in a week or so. Other insects have been busy around our dead rat. These are sexton beetles. In the wild, they'll bury the carcasses of small mammals to protect them from rival insects. Their own larvae then break down the flesh. But in our box, things are not quite going to plan. Despite all the activity, our rat remains unburied. So I'll try laying out a new rat and see if they prefer that. but the most dramatic change has been in our kitchen. It's been overrun by the next agent of decay, mould.
Time-lapse captures the fruit in the bowl sagging as it rots. Patches of black mould have formed on a melon.
Moulds are masters of decay. They're a form of fungi, the most versatile and important decomposers on the planet. Fungi can rot almost anything. In our box, moulds are attacking our fruit and vegetables. And they're also on our meat, battling with the bacteria for dominance. It'll be fascinating to see how that one plays out. The typical house will contain about 1,000 different species of mould. They can start to grow the moment their spores land on a suitable food source. I want to see which ones are at work in our box.
George is wearing rubber gloves as he examines some dishes on a table.
Well, in the kitchen, there is mould absolutely everywhere. The vegetables in the tray here are covered in fungus. There's at least three sorts of fungus I can see. The hamburgers, the sausages, even the hamburgers are wrapped up and they are covered in mould. And that's looking quite... ooh, that might blow at any time. The soft fruit particularly have been attacked. The peaches have gone, really, there's mould everywhere. The melon's just incredible. It's really been hammered. Look at that, it's just covered all over there. I'm a little bit nervous about taking off this lid. Because this is going to be... ah! Oh, that's an incredible smell. It's almost sweet.
Sandwiches covered in a soft white mould.
It's an incredible sort of yeasty smell. The mould has just covered that entire box. That's actually quite beautiful in a bizarre way.
The delicate mould has a fur-like quality.
It's like just furry growths everywhere. That's amazing. That's only a week.
Tiny droplets of moisture within the fur-like structure.
In close-up, the unexpected beauty of mould is even clearer.
Hundreds of greeny-yellow particles growing on hair-like strands.
These networks of filaments we see on the surface of our bread are the fruiting body of the mould.
At even greater magnification, the particles are revealed to be clusters of spherical spores.
At the ends of the filaments are spore heads, each packed with individual spores, all waiting to be released to grow into new colonies. There are 500 spores in every cubic metre of air in the average home, so there's plenty of competition for the chance to attack our bread.
Different varieties and colours of spore, all supported by thin, hair-like strands.
I've asked Dr. Patrick Hickey, our fungi expert, to investigate which moulds have managed to gain control. Now, Patrick, it's only week one and we've got incredible fungal growth in the kitchen, particularly on the bread.
Well, the bread is a perfect food source for the fungi. The spores probably landed on the bread when it was being prepared, and they've grown quickly into the bread, and they're taking up the nutrients. What we're actually seeing is two molds meeting. In the background, you've got a kind of dark green grey mold. That's Penicillium, and these kind of bright dots on the front, those are the sporulating structures of Aspergillus. Competing, so they're kind of trying to out-compete each other for the bread, for the food resource.
Each mould is trying to seize territory by outgrowing its competitors. but they're also using powerful chemical weapons to try to kill off other molds and rival decomposers like bacteria. In the case of penicillium, the toxin it produces to win the battle for decay has turned out to be highly beneficial to us. We call it penicillin. But not all molds are good for us. Now, I have to admit, I sometimes cut the mold off bits of bread and toast it. Is that really harmful?
Well, what you're scraping off is actually just the tip of the iceberg, because the fungus grows deep into the bread. And it also depends on what kind of mold is growing in the bread. You've got various different molds, some of which are completely harmless. You've got others like Aspergillus, which produce deadly mycotoxins. These are toxic chemicals which can rot your liver, they can give you cancer.
So what you're saying is I shouldn't really do that. It's dangerous. I should just throw it in the bin.
Absolutely. I mean, fungus actually penetrates quite deep into the bread, so you're not going to get rid of the toxins and the mould just by scraping it off.
Most of us might prefer not to have to cope with mouldy bread in the first place. Moulds and other type of fungi are the things that ruin our food and may cause us harm. But fungi are vital to life on this planet.
Toadstools growing.
They're amongst the Earth's oldest life forms. On land, they predate plants by at least 300 million years. And they rise to almost any challenge.
One toadstool sprouts a remarkable skirt of fungal latticework. Next, a highly magnified ant.
There is a fungus growing inside the brain of this ant. It's producing chemicals that control the ant's behaviour, forcing it to climb to the top of a plant. Then the killer fungus bursts out of the ant's head, allowing its spores to spread.
A long tendril extends from the dead ant's head.
Fungi have found ways to work on a microscopic level too. This one is lying in wait for tiny roundworms. At the right moment, it strangles them in a vice-like grip, then feeds on their flesh.
Yellow fingers of fungus.
But it's fungi's unrivaled ability to decay organic matter that makes them so important to us. A world where fungi couldn't decay things would be a very different place. To see just how different, we have to go back in Earth's history to a period when a new form of organic matter emerged, one that challenged fungi's powers of decay. The fate of life on Earth hung in the balance. Rewind 300 million years to the Carboniferous period, a time when plants, struggling to compete for sunlight, had evolved into trees.
Towering trunks.
That new organic material was wood, and it gave plants the strength to grow taller. But this evolutionary leap left fungi behind. They weren't able to decompose wood. The delicate mechanism of decay had been upset. Without decay, the trees grew, died, and lay where they fell. The effect on the planet's climate was spectacular. Professor Lynn Boddy is an expert in the history of fungi.
Trees absorb carbon dioxide from the air, they absorb nutrients from the soil, and then the carbon is locked up within the trees. So when they fall and die, the carbon is still locked up inside them.
So huge changes simply because trees can't decay.
Absolutely.
With fungi unable to break down wood, over time, more and more carbon was removed from the air and locked up in dead trees. The Earth's atmosphere began to change.
A thunderstorm over a forest.
Oxygen levels shot up from 20 to 30% as carbon dioxide levels dropped. This allowed insects to grow to gigantic proportions. Spiders were as wide as a human head. dragonflies were 10 times larger than they are today. If the atmosphere had stayed like this, life on our planet would have looked very different. The stumbling block for fungi was a molecule in trees called lignin. It's what makes wood tough. It took 50 million years for fungi to evolve a way to overcome it. And Lynn is able to show me the modern descendants of the fungi that solved the problem.
Pick up that log there. Yeah. We could have a better look. No, the one underneath, that one, yeah.
Now, the first thing I see about it, it's not heavy at all.
Light as a feather.
It hardly weighs anything.
Yes, it's been rotted. And again, you can see this is really white.
Why is it white?
It's white because the fungi have broken down the lignin that was in the wood.
Which would be brown normally.
Which is brown colour.
It's pretty easy to see what effect the fungi have had on the wood, but can we actually see the fungi themselves?
We can't actually see them rot in the wood, not with our naked eye, because they're microscopic. Actually,
to show me the fungi in action, Lynn has grown this sample in soil.
What we've got here is a little piece of beech wood that's got the fungus growing in it, and then we put the wood on top of this soil and the fungus has grown out of the wood, looking for other pieces of wood that they can colonise and get food from.
The fungus sends out a network of tiny threads called hyphae.
They've aggregated together so that we can actually see them with the naked eye.
Good, and they're heading off to find other bits to eat?
That's exactly right.
The hyphae release powerful enzymes into the wood. They are able to break down the lignin into nutrients the fungi can then absorb. This releases carbon from the wood back into the air. It was the evolution of these enzymes that allowed fungi to rebalance the Earth's atmosphere.
If those fungi weren't here today, then decay would come to a grinding halt and we'd be in a similar position to what we were in the Carboniferous period.
A toadstool growing on the forest floor.
By evolving the ability to unlock the carbon in dead wood, fungi saved the world. We still rely on this delicate balance between all living things and the agents that can decompose them.
The edges of the toadstool crinkle as it thickens. Day 16. George stands in front of the monitors, studying events inside the box.
At the Afterlife House, another 8 days have gone by. Just after my last visit, we captured something extraordinary. The new rat that I left out in the garden has been buried by the sexton beetles, as I hoped it would be. Despite their size, it took the two of them less than 12 hours to get the whole carcass underground and away from rival decomposers. The female will lay her eggs in the rat so her young will have food to eat when they hatch. In about a month's time, we'll dig up the rat and see what the beetle larvae have done.
The tip of the rat's tail is all that remains of it above ground.
Elsewhere in the box, bacteria and mould are still battling it out on the meat. The bacteria inside this sealed pack of burgers are hard at work, producing this build-up of gas. I'm not looking forward to smelling that.
The meat packaging has become bloated with air.
Where meat was left exposed to the air, like these sausages, mould has been able to move in, suggesting that the bacteria have been overwhelmed. But just over 2 weeks into our project, and an army of even more voracious decomposers is taking control. The maggot population has exploded. Our pig is literally seething with them. Maggots are some of decay's most effective operators. The question is, how long will it take them to munch their way through the contents of our house? Well, I haven't even got into the box and already I can see escaping maggots. So even though we try really carefully to keep all the insects on the inside. Some have escaped. They can squeeze through the tiniest gap.
Maggots crawling beneath a grill in the floor.
The time-lapse cameras have shown a real fever pitch, especially with the fish and the chicken. I just want to show you the fish, though. This has been completely eaten out. If I just... Look at that. Look at the inside of that. It is just a writhing mass of maggot. And the smell of ammonia is just overpowering. They've eaten everything. They've eaten all the flesh. All that remains is the dry skin on the outside and the bones. These are the most efficient recyclers on the planet. I think they're just amazing insects.
The slimy, wriggling mass of maggots.
It's 15 days since I released about 100 blowflies into the box. As soon as they mate, female flies look for a place to lay eggs, up to 300 at a time. The gases given off in the very early stages of decomposition will have attracted them to the dead meat and fish. They're the ideal food source for the maggots when they start to emerge around 24 hours later. Now they've hatched, these maggots only have one aim: to eat non-stop. Now, I've got the thermal image camera here, and this is actually quite a useful item because it can show heat that's produced by organisms. Now, the fly larvae, when they feed en masse, they do generate quite a bit of heat. Now, I'm just shining it on the chicken drumsticks, which are cold. They're not hot at all. The chicken's not very hot. But, oh, look at that. The hamburgers are absolutely glowing like a beacon. Now, that means that there are lots of fly larvae in there, and they're generating masses of heat, which actually makes them grow faster.
The burgers being consumed by larvae.
Our time-lapse camera shows how maggots feed as a pack, so they can share not just heat, but digestive enzymes as well. They carefully coordinate their movements. As the meat in one burger runs out, the maggots move together, almost as a single unit, over to the fresh supplies of the second burger. Maggots are a perfectly adapted mechanism for turning dead meat into flies. At the head end, you've got these amazing hooks, which are basically just a pair of really sharp curved hooks with which the fly maggot rasps its way or rips its way through food.
The black hooks set within the maggot's translucent head.
As you move further down, you see that it hasn't got any legs. There isn't any obvious head, thorax and abdomen. But what it has got are these bands of raised little bumps. They're like spikes for a grub, if you like. They're essentially bands of raised welts which help the maggot move through its food. So it's essentially in a pile of slop. By having these raised bands of welts around them, they're able to undulate through the food because otherwise it's very hard to move. At the other end, and let's go down to the back end, let's move back down. Now, these two little structures here are actually the breathing holes of the fly. These are the spiracles through which it gets its air, its oxygen. And they're on the rear end, so it has a pair of them. They're quite big. And so it's able to insert its head right into wet food and still feed while its rear end is in the air. All in all, it is just about the perfect eating machine. To me, maggots are the clearest example we've seen so far of the fundamental principle behind decay: recycling the nutrients from dead animals and turning it into new life.
But of course, for many of us, they represent everything that's disgusting about decay. I'm intrigued as to what these strong feelings of revulsion are, and so I've devised a little test, and I'm going to put a £5 note inside a plastic bag. I'm going to hide it inside a tub, inside which I will put loads of maggots. So we're going to end up with a pretty simple test, which is essentially this. A large box full of maggots writhing around and a £5 note. Now, I reckon only one person in 10 will be able to overcome their deep-seated revulsion for maggots and put their hand in to retrieve the fibre. Well, we'll find out.
George approaches some visitors with a tub of maggots.
Right, who'd be happy to put their hand in a bucket of maggots, a tub of maggots for a fibre? Oh, well, you would you?
It looks like my bin at home now.
Can't do it. £5 note.
Can't do it.
It's a little gross that they're now writhing on my fingers.
Oh, no.
Yeah. No.
No, no. No, no.
No, I can't do it.
£5 note. You're nearly there, you're nearly there. You've so nearly got it. Yes!
One woman succeeded.
This feeling of disgust is an emotion that evolved over thousands of years. It's not just maggots. All signs of decay revolt us. It's a great mechanism for stopping us from eating food that might make us sick. But it's also why we so rarely look at decay. We're hardwired to be repulsed by it. In the next few weeks, I hope our afterlife house will start to show why this disgusting process is so important. Why decomposition is vital to life. And there's one part of our box where we're attempting to demonstrate that in a unique way. These dead mustard plants are the starting point of an experiment that will help me trace how new life emerges from old. I've made liquid compost from the mustard and fed it to these seedlings. We plan to track individual nitrogen atoms from the dead mustard leaves to see if they're reused in the new plants. No one has ever followed the cycle of life in this way before. And in a couple of weeks' time, we can come back, and with any luck, we'll be able to track this vital part of the cycle from death and decay to new life.
Day 23. Lights come on in the afterlife house as George approaches and walks up to the monitors.
It's the 23rd day in the afterlife house. The first waves of decay have now passed. Vegetables and soft fruit have been consumed by mould. In some places, there's not much left for them to feed on. They'll need to find new supplies.
Flies crawling on the decayed fruit.
Anything with a hard skin, like this orange, remains apparently unaffected. Maggot activity, too, has begun to die down, leaving behind a sort of meat slurry in our burger packet, where these late developers eke out a meal from the remains.
Black, pellet-like cocoons.
The majority of the maggots have started to pupate, the next stage before they turn into adults. So we should soon see an explosion in our fly numbers. And our chicken has gone through an alarming metamorphosis. Bacteria continue to rot away at it, releasing gases as they feed. This week, the carcass bloated to even more grotesque proportions before deflating as the gases escaped. 1 month into the project, and our house really isn't somewhere you'd want to visit, unless you had to. Every time I enter the box, there's one thing that hits me, and that is
They're all pervading hideous stink of decay. Imagine sticking your nose deep into a rubbish bin. That's the smell I'm talking about. But if you can get beyond your revulsion, the smell of decay gives real clues to its underlying mechanisms and the different ways plants and animals are broken down. So I want to share some of these smells with our audience. And so I've got two tubs. One's got vegetables in it, which are a bit far gone, and one's got a piece of meat, also far gone. And I want to see which of these two our visitors find the most disgusting.
George opens one of the plastic containers.
This is decaying vegetables, right? So I'm going to have a smell of that. See what you think.
It smells like vegetables still.
Yeah. Have a good old sniff. It's not that bad, is it?
That's not terrible.
That's not terrible. Smells like okay, I'm warning you. I think it'll be fair to warn you. This is not nice. Have a good old smell of that.
That smells like a pig barn.
Some people gag at the smell of the meat.
As expected, the meat gets the same response every time. That's pretty grim, isn't it?
His eyes are watering.
Your eyes are watering. Rotting meat is far more dangerous to us than rotting vegetables, so we're programmed to find it more offensive. But what are we actually smelling? Plant cells are largely made up of starches and sugars, so when fruit and veg decay, they ferment, turning the sugars into alcohol and releasing volatile compounds which have a sweet odour. But fish and meat are going to produce really smelly gases like hydrogen sulfide, sulfur dioxide and ammonia. So I'm just going to extract some of the gases from the inside of this decaying chicken, suck it up into this syringe, and then I'm going to just blow it over a gas analyzer. And look what happens. Look at that. The hydrogen sulfide has shot up to 10%. That really is smelly.
George looks quite revolted by the smell. Now, a dead rat covered in mold.
Unlike plant cells, animal cells are made up largely of proteins. The foul-smelling gases are produced when these proteins are broken down into amino acids. To understand more about that process and why the smell it generates is such an important part of decay, I'm going to experience rotting flesh on a scale that even the box can't provide.
Flies are crawling on a number of pig carcasses that are hanging up behind some netting.
At a secret location in northwest England, a grotesque but important experiment is taking place. 65 pig carcasses are being left to rot. They're part of an investigation into exactly how flesh decomposes under different conditions.
Some carcasses are contained in wire cages.
And the smell of death is everywhere.
A maggot-filled slime.
Well, I haven't been here very long, and there's a real whiff of dead animal. Sometimes the wind changes direction, and it just catches your nose. I'm used to dealing with smells and excrement and stuff, but I'm just wondering if I'm really up to this, because there's a lot of dead animals around here.
More rotting pigs hanging within an enclosure.
The pigs are stand-ins for human remains. The aim of the experiment is to help police forensic teams establish an accurate time of death based on the state of decomposition. Dr. Carl Simmons is the research director for the project, and she's going to help me understand how the different stages of decay account for what we smell. Good morning, Tal.
Good morning, George. How are you?
No, I won't take hands.
Possibly not.
What have you got here?
Well, I'll tell you what. Let's move the cage, and then we'll be all able right. to see it a bit better. Well, we've got a pig that we put out 4 days ago. He's just begun to really show some of the early stages of decomposition.
The first thing that's obvious to me is that it's swollen up mm-hmm. there.
Yeah, he's beginning to bloat. He may get a lot more bloated in the next couple of days. And that's due to the cellular breakdown inside the body. So all those cells are starting to collapse, the cell membrane is going, it's exuding all the fluids inside the cell, and a lot of those contain kind of digestive enzymes, so he's starting to eat himself from the inside.
The moment blood stops flowing in an animal, this process of cell death begins. As each cell membrane splits, enzymes inside are released and begin to break down the other cells. Bacteria then start to feed on these protein-rich contents, releasing the gases that are bloating the pig.
All of these gases that are being produced inside are coming up the digestive tract.
And so that smell is actually coming out.
That's right.
And that's what attracts the flies.
Exactly. We can't smell it, but the flies can right
now. Yeah, I can't
really
smell. It's not obvious at all.
No.
But as I know from the rotting meat and fish in the box, it doesn't take long for the smell to become something we can detect. Oh, that's a lot worse.
Let's pull this off and we can see a bit. Yeah, he's much more advanced, as you can see.
We're now smelling a cocktail of highly volatile gases and liquids produced not just by the breakdown of the animal proteins, but by the agents of decay themselves.
The body is composed largely of water. So as the cells break down and the cell walls go, you get the liquid coming from that, you get the liquid that was part of the organs, and you get the liquid that the maggots are also excreting as part of their digestive process too.
If you look at it really closely, it's actually rather interesting.
Mm. No, it's a fascinating process.
It's attractive, but it's, you know.
I wouldn't go that far out.
Many of the molecules in this cocktail of decomposition fluids have a particular property. They're highly electrically charged. It's a bit like when you rub a balloon on a woolen jumper. The molecules of the balloon pick up a charge, which means they stick to other materials they come in contact with, which is why the smell of decay can literally stick to our clothes. And it also explains why decay can leave a trace that lingers far longer than you might think.
Top off.
Tal's colleague Peter Cross is measuring what effect the decomposing pigs are having on the surrounding earth.
We can just draw the water up. Oh, it's even frothy.
Oh, it's foaming.
Foaming, yeah.
Well, it's clearly not fresh.
George is repelled by the smell of the water.
That's pretty bad.
This is soil water taken from the site of a buried pig carcass.
This machine is passing an electrical current through the soil water and then measuring how well the soil water conducts that electricity.
The contaminated water is 30 times more conductive than soil water taken from 10 metres away. This is the trace that decay leaves behind.
We think that because of all the electrolytes that are leaching into the soil water from the decomposing pig, that they are changing the electrical properties of the soil water.
How long will that remain?
I would expect conductivity to continue increasing for up to 2 years.
So that really is a fingerprint of death, isn't
Absolutely,
it?
Absolutely, yes.
Three people carrying equipment into a graveyard next to an old church.
And it's a fingerprint that allows scientists to detect signs of decay, not just over years, but over centuries.
OK, Chris, I'm going to grab the remote probes.
Dr. Jamie Pringle is a forensic geophysicist. Today, he's using the conductive qualities of decomposition fluids to identify unmarked graves in this churchyard. Some are estimated to be 200 years old. Jamie's kit sends an electrical current into the ground to measure conductivity. It can detect electrically charged molecules left behind by the bodies buried centuries ago.
Oh, that's interesting, lads. Looks like it's going down there.
Jamie's looking at a laptop.
I've just downloaded the data from the machine, and the results show there's 1, 2, 3... 4, 5 areas of blue, which means it's high conductivity results, which suggests to me that's where the graves are going to be located and where the decompositional fluids have been retained in the soil.
This technology opens up new possibilities in forensic science.
Not only can it be used for unmarked graves, it can be used for other things as well, such as looking for buried murder victims.
For crime fighters, the powerful lingering effect of decay turns out to be one of its most useful qualities.
The markings on an old tombstone. Day 30. Time-lapse footage of the rotting food within the house.
We're more than halfway through our investigation of what happens when decay is allowed to run its course in a typical home. We set out to see how quickly its contents would be broken down and transformed into new life. 1 month in, and we have our most striking result yet. The clue is in the rapidly increasing fly numbers.
A fly resting on a decomposing leaf.
These flies are the first generation to be born and bred in the box. 2 weeks ago, they were the maggots that were so active in all the meat. Once a maggot has fed enough, it pupates, and within about 7 days, the adult blowfly emerges. It inflates a soft, spongy sac on top of its head to help push itself out.
The newborn fly lies on its back, much of its body still a translucent white.
Then blood pumps into the wings, spreading them out, ready for takeoff.
The wings slowly unfurl like a blossoming flower. Now, a fly rubs its front legs together as it rests on the pig carcass.
There isn't anything better than flies to illustrate the transformative power of decay. The fly larvae have eaten this pig, and I want to show you just how little is left behind. Get this torn back. I'm cutting my finger. It's quite tough. The outer surface of the skin is now quite dry. Look at that. Oh, ammonia. The smell of ammonia here is just quite overpowering. And if I peel it back, look at that. What we've got here is basically dry skin. There's a few bits of fat left here. All the meat's gone. The fly larvae have eaten this pig out completely. All that's left are some ribs and fat, and all that meat that was once pig is now flying around this room. Who says pigs can't fly?
Day 37. The six monitors display the fly activity in the box.
7 days later, and the number of blowflies is becoming a problem inside the house.
The remains of the fruit are swarming with them.
Well, it's a week since I was here before, and as I predicted, the numbers of flies have absolutely skyrocketed. They've gone through the roof. So I'm going to wear an all-in-one suit for a bit of protection this week. I reckon there could be as many as 10,000 flies inside. Because our box is sealed, they can't escape to find new sources of food and places to lay their eggs. I'm worried that their sheer numbers may disrupt the natural course of decay elsewhere in the box. Well, there are just now simply too many flies in here. It's becoming quite unpleasant. And it's causing a problem because of the fly speck. That's their excrement, which they leave on the surfaces inside the glass everywhere. So it's time I try to reduce them a little bit manually. And the trouble is that they're flying quite low and they're sitting on surfaces. It's actually very hard to get them. And the trouble is half the flies are actually drunk. Because over there in the fruit bowl, it's all become alcoholic in there. And the flies are actually flying under the influence at the moment, which is probably why there's so many of them on the floor. You can hear them. It's like a sort of constant buzz. This is pretty unpleasant, I gotta say. Whoa! Woo-hoo. Look at this.
Flies on a sugar bowl.
It's no wonder that flies are so hard to capture. Their compound eyes give them 360-degree vision, so they can respond to movement in less than 30 milliseconds. Me and my net can only do so much. It will be hunger that kills off these flies in the remaining few weeks as their food supplies in the box run out. Their role in our project is coming to an end. We should start to see other insects moving in to carry on the process of breaking down what's left of the meat. In the meantime, the fly's need for food is affecting one of our other agents of decay.
A flourishing brown mold escapes the sandwich box.
6 weeks in, and mold is still ravaging the sandwich box. It's even grown out from under the lid, and it's attracted the attention of our starving flies.
George lifts the lid.
Now, this to me, Patrick, is one of the most amazing things I've ever seen. Patrick Hickey has returned to investigate what's been happening to the molds in our house. How many actual species of fungus are here?
Oh, at least 20 or 30, maybe more. Maybe
20 or 30 species of fungus? Mm. I just can't wait to have a sort of...
It's the perfect environment. I mean, some of those actually are fairly dangerous. I mean, one of the ones one of the molds here, Aspergillus flavus, which is a kind of greeny yellow one, can produce quite nasty toxins, so you certainly want to be careful.
I see. But look at this, look at that. I mean, it's a solid mat.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
All now, there are the layers of sandwich. Mm. And it's all the way through, it's completely through. Now, there aren't any flies here, of course.
Yeah, well, it was sealed in the box, so the flies couldn't get in. Big contrast there to the fruit bowl, which was left open, and a couple of weeks ago was really covered in thick layers of fungus.
Look at the fly. Look.
And the flies have stripped it bare. I mean, the flies have gone in there, they've been eating the fungus, they've been eating the spores, and really just recycling the fungi.
So fruit has become mold, mold has become flies... Flies are flying off somewhere else, and if they were outside, they'd be eaten by something.
Outside in the garden, other forms of fungi rely on insects to help them do their job. This is the fruiting body of a stinkhorn fungus. The rest of the fungus is below ground, feeding on wood and plant matter in the soil. These stalks emerge when the fungus is ready to fruit, growing up to 15 centimetres in less than 24 hours. Flies congregating en masse round the head of the mushroom.
When they break through the top layer of soil, they release an intense smell that flies find irresistible. The smell of dead and decaying meat. The flies strip the jelly-like flesh from the mushroom and help spread its spores. Even after 30 years of studying biology, I'm still amazed by the complex behaviour of these simple organisms.
The woodpile box.
But stinkhorns aren't the strangest things feeding on the decaying wood in our garden. Hidden away in our woodpile is something even more intriguing. This is a slime mould. It's the largest single-celled organism on Earth, and it can grow to more than 3 square metres.
The sickly yellow slime spreading over some bark.
Scientists have recently discovered that these primitive life forms have some rather sophisticated talents.
A sign reads, Plant Sciences. A man in a white coat is placing a sample of the slime onto a plastic tray.
At Oxford University, Dr. Mark Fricker is one of a team of botanists and computer scientists studying a species of slime mould called Ficerum polycephalum. For years, slime molds have fascinated scientists with their remarkable ability to solve simple mazes. Put food at the end of a maze, and the slime mold will find the quickest route through. But scientists started to wonder if the mold could do more than just perform clever tricks.
You can set them lots of little tasks, and you can allow them to forage and connect up little food sources to see what sort of network they would make.
Okay.
And a geometric shape, so a square or something more complicated, yeah, is interesting, but we wanted to see whether they would be able to solve a slightly more complex problem.
Mark is recreating an experiment he worked on with colleagues at Tokyo University. He takes a blob of slime mold and then surrounds it with a pattern of oat flakes, an irresistible treat to the slime mold. What happens next is recorded by a time-lapse camera. The slime mold locates the oat flakes by growing out in all directions. But within hours, the slime mold shrinks back, leaving an intricate web of tubes that connect the oat flakes. It's these tubes that transfer nutrients around the slime mold. Incredibly, everything you can see is part of one single cell.
It needs to build a network that's quite efficient to transport all those resources around. At the same time, that network mustn't cost too much. It mustn't take up too many of its own resources. And then the other problem it has is it's going to be subject to damage. And so if there was only ever one connection, there's a risk that that would break.
The slime mold takes no chances. It grows backup routes to make sure that its food supply isn't cut off. But there's something even more extraordinary about what the slime mold has done. Mark hasn't just laid out the flakes in a random pattern.
The large blob in the middle is Tokyo.
Right.
And each of these food sources is positioned as one of the cities nearby Tokyo.
So it's a recreation of the area around Tokyo.
Indeed. So this is actually what it's based on. This is the rail network around Tokyo. And we can superimpose that over. OK, so we're in a line.
That's identical. It's absolutely identical.
So you see a lot of these connections, it's formed the same sort of links. It's got a few extra ones in as well. It's a slightly more resilient network than the ones that the engineers designed.
You're telling me, wait a minute, that this slime mold has built a better network.
A remarkably similar
network. Than the humans
network.
Built.
Yes.
The Tokyo rail system is one of the most efficient and well-organised in the world. It took lots of skilled engineers using lots of brain power to plan it. Yet somehow, slime mold has achieved the same goal, how to efficiently link together multiple locations. Slime mold has also been put to work in other parts of the world. Here it tackles some of Britain's major motorways. And this is its take on the best routes around Spain. And here are some interesting alternatives to America's Route 66. What is the slime mold actually displaying here?
It's a sort of smart behaviour. It hasn't got a brain, it hasn't got a nervous system, but it still seems to be able to solve these sorts of complex problems with very simple rules. And that's something that the computer scientists that we're working with are getting very interested in, and whether or not you can take inspiration from this system and apply it to other sorts of problems.
From the complex network of interconnected mold to George driving down a country lane in a car.
So how does one of the most simple life forms on Earth, a single-celled amoeba that spends most of its time on woodland waste, match its wits against transport engineers and computer scientists? The clue seems to lie in its extraordinary biology.
The car comes to a stop.
Professor Bruce Ing is a self-confessed slime mold obsessive. He's going to help me track down some slime mold in one of its native habitats. So slime molds are not rare things, are they?
No, no, they're very common indeed everywhere.
But overlooked?
Overlooked because they're shy, not easy to find unless you know where to look and how
to look. Slime mold.
Shy slime mold, yeah.
The two men enter a wooded area. They start to examine the bark on trees and fallen branches.
Do you remember seeing the film The Blob?
Yes.
A giant mass of jelly eating caravans.
It was a slime mold?
It was a slime mold.
But not one we'll find here.
Not as big as that, I hope.
The search continues.
Bruce's 54 years in the field prove vital as we hunt the elusive slime mold. After half an hour, he finds what we're looking for. Not quite a sheet I was hoping for.
No, indeed not, but still the real McCoy.
Yeah. This small patch of orange is creeping slime mold. Up close, you can see how it's constantly pulsating. When one part of it finds something it likes to eat, it pulses more rapidly. Scientists believe that it's this pulsing that helps transmit information across the entire cell, allowing the slime mold to move towards its food source.
It spreads like a ripple on the surface of some water.
These pulsations control where and how they grow across the forest floor, or even around the oat flakes of the Tokyo rail map. What's so special about slime mold is that it can use this information to make multiple decisions simultaneously. Pretty ingenious stuff for a single-celled organism.
Tendrils of creeping slime.
Slime molds are what's known as self-organising systems. It's not a unique phenomenon in nature. Flocks of birds work in a similar way. With no leader, no overall control, the flock nevertheless acts as a single unit. But slime molds can do something that flocks of birds could never do. Meet the Phibot, the world's first slime mold-controlled robot. The Phibot is the brainchild of Dr. Soichiro Tuda and Dr. Klaus-Peter Zauner from Southampton University. Their robot takes its orders from a tiny blob of slime mold. I sort of don't believe you. I want to see it working. Prove it.
All right. Flip the switch. So let's
just seems almost unbelievable. It's not instant, is it? It's not sort of instant. Oh. Wow. That's fantastic. The slime mold sits on an electronic chip inside the robot. As it transmits information around its single cell by pulsing, the robot detects these pulses and translates them into much larger movements across the surface of the table. How did you get the idea for having a live organism inside a robot?
One inspiration source, obviously, from the Daleks, from Doctor Who.
This is inspired by a Dalek?
Yes. So
it's the same thing, isn't it?
Exactly.
You've got a live organism in the machine which controls it. The Phibot is pioneering a new approach to computing. Today's computers use a single central processing unit to do their thinking. But the slime mold has no need to ask a brain what to do. All parts of the cell just work together for the good of the whole.
That simple organism inside processes information in a completely, radically different way from our conventional computing technology. So we want to learn more how it can do that information processing.
So slime mold could hold the secret to a revolution in computing, or even the creation of artificial intelligence. Not bad for something you can find in your wood pile.
Day 44. George studies the afterlife house monitors again.
There's only a week left to go in our project to study decay in a typical house and garden. The pace of change in the box is beginning to slow down. But even now, decay is following an ordered sequence. What one decomposer leaves behind is food for others. Well, it's day 44, and the one thing that's immediately obvious is it doesn't smell nearly as bad in here as it did. It's quite pleasant. The other thing that's obvious is there are very few flies now. The majority of the flies that hatched out have died. There aren't as many dead ones lying about as I expected, but it looks as if a few flies have got themselves stuck in this bottle of wine, as they've obviously been searching for something to drink. This is solid. Ah, look at this. Oh, my God. Ah! That is incredible. I can't get them all out. I've never seen so many flies in one bottle in my life. I can barely get them out. That sort of explains why I wasn't seeing as many flies flying around as I expected. It's because most of them were in here. Look at it. It's just incredible. It's thick. That's thick flies. Look at that. Conditions in the box are very dry. All that remains of the meat are hardened chunks of sinew and skin. Even if the flies had survived, there's nothing left for another generation of maggots to feed on. But this is the perfect fodder for beetles. This dried meat gives off a far less pungent odour, but the smell it does produce gives them a signal that starts the next stage in decay. Decay happens in a series of waves, so even with this fish, which is now dry and hard, there are beetle larvae who will eat this, so there isn't anything wasted. And that's what I'm hunting for now. I'm hunting for the larvae of a larder beetle, and there is one right there. Larder beetle larvae are present in around half of all homes. They only colonise a carcass once it's become dried and desiccated. Their powerful jaws allow them to eat through flesh, hair and skin, and they can strip an animal down to the bone. This stage in decay moves slowly, though. Larder beetle larvae take months to pupate into these adults. The job of recycling what remains in the box could take generations of them years to complete.
A black and yellow beetle.
But another beetle in our box does allow us to see how effective these insects can be.
Time-lapse footage of the dead rat being pulled underground.
36 days ago, two sexton beetles took less than 12 hours to bury our dead rat.
George is holding a pair of tweezers.
What I'm aching to do now is a spot of archaeology, because what's happened is the sexton beetles have taken the rat down and they will have formed it into a ball on which their larvae have fed. And hopefully, for 36 days should be enough time, I should find a crypt in which the rat sits, surrounded by its own fur, which they've smeared on the outside, and there should just be bones left. So this for me is about as exciting as it gets. So I'm just going to use a Hoover to gently take away the soil. What is amazing about these insects is that they're one of the very, very few insects who look after their young. They actually take care of the young. So once they've dragged the prey down and hidden it underground, they will lay the eggs around the crypt, if you like, and then the larvae will move in and feed, and they'll help them to feed as well. So now we're beginning to see a shape here. Oh, this is very exciting. This, turn that off. Now, I wonder if I can just free it. There it is. Now that is just fantastic.
George is holding a round mass of decomposing fur.
And there, look at that. That's all the remains there of that rat. You can just see the top part of the skull there and the teeth, and the rest of it has completely disappeared. There is nothing left of that rat.
A piece of the rat's skull. Day 52. George steps inside the afterlife house.
We're now at week 8. We're nearing the end of our project. But there's one final stage of decay I want to investigate. And it's probably the most important. We've watched as the nutrients locked up in plant and animal remains have been reused by other organisms. In the process, complex things like chickens, rats, and fruit have become simpler ones: insects, fungi, bacteria. But the true power of decay is its ability to reduce complex things right back to the most basic building blocks of life. And all through the project, that's been quietly happening in a corner of the box. This is one of the best places to see decay in action. Now, we set this up 8 weeks ago, and it was piled to the top with plant material. It's now completely decayed down. We've been adding to it. And what I really want to do now is to just have a good look inside and see what's going on. Now, decay has been happening here, and the further you go down, the more advanced it is. There's a snail on my trowel handle.
The tentacular eyes of a snail.
As all gardeners know, compost heaps turn dead plants into a form of nutrients that new plants can use.
A woodlouse.
On the surface, animals like snails, slugs, and worms begin the process by eating the remains of plants, helping to break them into smaller pieces. The waste they excrete and anything else left behind is eaten by even smaller creatures like these mites, too tiny to be seen with the naked eye.
A mite's crawling across some putrefied plant matter.
And this process continues down through the compost, ever smaller organisms reducing the plant waste to ever smaller components, until tiny fungi and bacteria are able to break down the very cells of the plant. A teaspoon of soil contains 4 billion microorganisms. They finally release the nitrogen and other building blocks of organic life back into the soil. What we end up with is an incredibly fine soil, which is the result of the breakdown processes of countless, countless organisms. So having begun with a big pile of green material, you may think that that is an end point, but it's not. It's just the beginning.
George is holding a clump of moist soil-like material.
From here, life can begin to rebuild. To me, this is the most amazing moment in the story of decay.
Speeded up footage records the growth of some young plants.
When we began 8 weeks ago, we wanted to demonstrate its significance in a unique way. This is probably one of the most important experiments that we've set up in the box. And these may look like ordinary plants, but they're going to show us a part of the story that's absolutely crucial. These are the marigolds and radish seedlings I planted back at the beginning of the project. They've flourished into mature plants. I've been feeding them with a special liquid compost made from plants grown using chemically labelled nitrogen atoms. If everything has gone according to plan, we should be able to track how individual atoms of nitrogen are transferred from the mustard plant to our seedlings. From death to life.
Inside the box.
We sent samples of our plants to Professor Malcolm Clench. It's time to find out if our experiment has worked.
First one is from the marigold. Right. So what you can see at the moment is just a photograph of the marigold leaves themselves. Yeah. Yeah, that's right.
he's able to pinpoint exactly where the labelled nitrogen has ended up.
Let's start to play through the little video clip. We'll come up with an overlay that shows the nitrogen in high abundance.
That is really clear.
Yes, it is very clear, isn't it?
Each one of these dots shows where we found traces of the labelled nitrogen from the mustard plant in our marigold leaf. White areas show where it's concentrated. How can we be 100% sure that that labelled nitrogen has come from our experiment and not from anywhere else?
Well, the form of nitrogen that we're using, nitrogen 15, is only 0.3% naturally abundant. And we can see here areas of high intensity, and they can only have come from the mustard, which was grown just with the labelled nitrogen in.
So that is the definitive proof positive
that we've got
of the cycle of life.
Indeed.
Right there on the screen.
Indeed. I think you're going to be really pleased with the radish result. We can see, first off,
a very nice radish.
A very nice radish, one that you prepared earlier. As if by magic.
Look at that. That is absolutely cast iron proof that we have transferred material, an element in this case, from one organism, one plant that was dead and decayed, fed to something else, and it takes it up.
It's incontrovertible.
This is what I hoped we'd see when we began our project. It's the fundamental principle of decay revealed in front of our eyes. For me, this is as good as it gets.
A yellow blossom on top of one of the newly grown plants.
2 months of decay have transformed the afterlife box. Little is left of the fresh food we began with. And what remains will continue its inexorable journey back to the basic building blocks of life. But as our plant experiment so dramatically demonstrated, what we have witnessed in the box is a process of renewal that we are all part of.
The rotten fruit becomes fresh once more.
It's a real sort of a snapshot of everyone's life, and to see things changing as they do is a fantastic experiment.
We'd be in a horrible mess if we didn't have decay, when you see what nature can do to get rid of all the dead things in the world.
We need that decay to happen in order for life to go on, I guess.
We tend to think of life as a linear process with a beginning and an end. Things go from life to death. But I hope the box has shown this process in a new light. Life is an ever-repeating cycle, one that's not just happening here, but everywhere on the planet. The plants and animals of Earth's ecosystems rely on this continuing cycle. Even the atoms that make us up are recycled. They come from the food we eat, the air we breathe. They're in our flesh, blood, and bones. They've been used millions of times before, and they'll be used millions of times again.
George walks off past the glass walls of the afterlife house. Some electric blinds start to rise, and sunlight pours through the windows opposite the box, brightly illuminating it.
Coming up tonight on BBC Four, we're heading out into the blue as James Fox discovers an otherworldly hue to the history of art in three colours. That's next.